Welcome back to Dark Florida. I'm your host, Brooke Moreland, and tonight we're diving into a case that has puzzled investigators and divided opinions and haunted the minds of so many for over a decade. The mysterious and tragic death of Ellen Greenberg. But before we step into the shadows of this story, be sure to give us a follow on Instagram to find out everything that's happening behind the scenes at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. And if you have a story to share, would like to be a guest on the show, or have a suggested topic that I should cover, please email me at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/@darkflorida411. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/darkflorida. And be sure, wherever you're listening, to drop a 5-star review and share the show with a friend. It really helps. Now, tonight's story is not an easy one to listen to, but it's important to tell, and listener discretion is advised. It's a tale of a young woman with a bright future, full of life, love, and whose final hours remain a source of mystery and speculation. The more you dig, the stranger it becomes. A story that challenges assumptions, raises questions, and leaves you wondering what really happened. Now, let's start at the beginning with Ellen Ray Greenberg, who she was, her life, and the world she left behind. Ellen Ray Greenberg was born on June 23, 1983, to Josh and Sandy Greenberg, their one and only child in the absolute center of their universe. Her parents describe her as a bright light, quote, a really funny, adorable, very loving, bubbly young woman with a bright future ahead of her, end quote. In 1994, the Greenbergs moved to the Harrisburg area, where Sandy had grown up. Ellen was just entering middle school then, attending the Susquehanna Township Schools. And even as a teenager, she had what they described as a magnetic energy about her. She was the kind of person who made others instantly feel comfortable. She laughed easily and remembered the small details about people and had a way of connecting with everyone in her orbit. When it came time for college, Ellen attended Penn State University, a place that she quickly fell in love with. She majored in communications and joined campus activities and worked as a, quote, lionizer, one of those spirited ambassadors who greeted football players and their families and introduced them to the campus, and she even helped out on the field during games. She loved Penn State, and she loved the energy of the game day crowds. Her friends remember her as someone who was the bridge between people who might have never met otherwise. The camp friends, the high school friends, and the college friends, somehow they all became friends with each other because of Ellen. She just had that gift of connecting people. After graduating with her communications degree, Ellen thought she wanted to pursue a career in speech pathology, but after some time, she realized her heart was elsewhere and she wanted to be a teacher. So she went back to school at night, attending Temple University to earn her teaching credentials. A move that would eventually set her on a path that she had dreamed of, working with children. It was around this time that she met a young man named Sam Goldberg through a mutual friend. Sam worked as a television producer for NBC and later for Golf.com. Their relationship seemed to fall into place naturally. Two ambitious young professionals building their lives together in Philadelphia. Not long after, Ellen landed a job as a first grade teacher at the Winnetta Park Academy in Philadelphia. She loved it. Her classroom was described as being warm and colorful, filled with energy and laughter. Ellen was described as the kind of teacher that kids didn't forget. She gave hugs at the start and end of each day. and her students would run to her in the morning, excited to see her and excited to learn. While most kids would cheer for a substitute teacher, Ellen's students didn't want anyone else. They only wanted her. Her father once said, quote, "She felt good about what she was doing," end quote. And it showed. The kids adored her. The parents trusted her, and she was doing what she was meant to do. Since Ellen had earned her communications degree from Penn State and her teaching credentials from Temple University and Chestnut Hill College, she found a rhythm and she loved teaching by day and planning her future by night. She and Sam had recently gotten engaged and shared an apartment together in the Manayuk neighborhood of Philadelphia, a lively area filled with coffee shops, row houses, and young professionals just like them. Friends described Ellen as the kind of person who made life brighter, always smiling, always listening, and always giving. Her friends say she radiated kindness, and if you look at the pictures of her, she had that big, beaming smile and just warm, kind eyes. You can literally almost feel the joy that everyone talked about. She was so loved, she was thriving, and from the outside, everything in Ellen's life seemed to be falling perfectly into place. But as we know, things aren't always as they seem. Ellen's life seemed to be unfolding exactly as she hoped. Not long after she and Sam started dating, he proposed, and everyone was thrilled. Their friends and families were ecstatic, and the wedding was shaping up to be a fairy tale. They had chosen the elegant Hershey Hotel as their venue, a classic romantic spot known for its sweeping ballrooms and picturesque gardens. Guests were already marking their calendars and travel plans were being made, and the couple was deep in the whirlwind of wedding planning, choosing colors, flowers, menus, and music. It was the kind of celebration that people dream about, a perfect day waiting just ahead, a day that would never come. About 3 years into her teaching career, sometime in early 2010, Ellen called her parents out of the blue. Her voice sounded different, quieter, and more fragile. She told them she was thinking about leaving Philadelphia and that she wanted to come home to Harrisburg. She said she hadn't been feeling like herself and she had been struggling with a lot of anxiety, and that her job that she had once been so passionate about had started to feel overwhelming. For her parents, that call came as a shock. Ellen had always been high energy and optimistic. She had worked so hard to build this life. She loved teaching, she had what looked to be a supportive fiancé, and a wedding on the horizon. So to hear her suddenly say that she wanted to give it all up didn't make any sense. Her father gently suggested that before she made any major decisions, that she seek the help of a therapist or a psychiatrist, just to make sure she was getting the right kind of help. Ellen agreed, and she made the appointments and kept them. She met with a psychiatrist 3 times, January 12th, 17th, and 19th of 2011. She was prescribed medication for her anxiety, and within days, it seemed to be helping. Now, it should be noted that her psychiatrist prescribed her Klonopin and Ambien, and those were the only drugs found in her system at the time of her death. And her psychiatrist even notes in the visit notes that she did not seem suicidal. In fact, Ellen texts her mother after one of those appointments saying how relieved she felt and how the new medication was finally working. Her mom said she could feel the hope coming through that message, as if Ellen was turning a corner and getting back to herself. Things seemed to be improving, and she was talking about work again, making wedding plans, and feeling excited. Just 4 days before her death, Ellen had mailed out her save-the-date cards for the wedding that she and Sam were planning for that August. And she wasn't just preparing for her own big day, she was also helping one of her close friends plan her wedding also. That weekend, Ellen had plans to pick out her bridesmaid dress. Her friend picked her up that day, and she would later recall that something about Ellen felt off. Quote, "I could tell she wasn't herself. Even when I picked her up, she just looked disheveled. And Ellen was always so put together, hair done, her clothes perfect, but that day she didn't look like herself, end quote. When they went into the fitting room to try on the dresses, Ellen became emotional. She started to cry quietly, apologizing over and over, saying, "I'm so sorry. I know I'm not myself right now, but I'll get it together." Her friend didn't want to push her, and she could tell that Ellen didn't want to make the day about her. But Ellen did admit something that she had been thinking about quitting her job and moving home. Something that surprised her friend just as it had her parents. Her friend's father-in-law actually worked with Ellen at Juanita Park Academy, and he had nothing but praise for her. He said there was nothing going on at work that would have caused her this kind of stress, that everyone loved her there. January 26th, 2011. A cold, gray Wednesday in Philadelphia. A heavy winter storm was rolling in, blanketing the city with snow and ice. Schools were closing early and traffic was backing up, and most people were hurrying to get home and get out of the weather. For Ellen Greenberg, it was a snowy day, an unexpected early dismissal. She left her classroom at Juanita Park Academy around noon, and like most teachers that day, she was looking forward to getting home, cozying up, and maybe watching a movie after what had been a stressful few weeks. At 1:26 p.m., Ellen stopped to get gas where she would fill up her tank. This is the last confirmed sighting of her alive outside of her apartment. Surveillance footage shows her at the pump, bundled up against the cold, before heading straight home to her apartment that she shared with her fiancé, Sam. That afternoon, Sam also finished work early because of the blizzard. The couple was home together in their sixth-floor apartment, texting, checking emails, and relaxing as the snow piled up outside. According to phone and computer records, Ellen sent her last text at 3:47 p.m., and her final computer activity was logged at 4:46 p.m. At 4:50 p.m., security cameras in the building captured Sam heading to the gym located inside their complex. Roughly 40 minutes later, around 5:30 p.m., he was seen leaving the gym and returning to their apartment. That's when things start to get strange. When Sam tried to enter the couple's apartment, he said he couldn't, that the door's swing latch was locked from the inside, and it wasn't latched with a key. This was one of the metal swing bars you can only secure or release from inside the apartment. Sam said that he called out to Ellen and banged on the door and called her phone several times, but there was no answers. Neighbors later confirm that they heard him shouting for her and that his voice was echoing through the hallway. As minutes went by, Sam's text grew increasingly frustrated, and he sent a total of 9 messages to Ellen between 5:32 and 6:04 p.m. The first message says, "Hello." Then he writes, "Open the door." Then, "What are you doing?" Then he says, "I'm getting pissed." Then he says, "Hello." Then the next message says, "You better have an excuse." Then he says, "What the fuck?" Then he says, "Ah." And his final message says, quote, "You have no idea." After getting no response from Ellen, Sam went downstairs to the front desk. He asked the security guard if there was a tool that he could use to break the latch or if the guard could help him force the door open. The guard told him he couldn't assist him with breaking in, and Sam returned several times, reportedly agitated, before finally going up to the apartment alone. According to Sam, he eventually broke down the door himself, and what he found inside was truly horrific. Ellen was lying on the kitchen floor, unresponsive and surrounded by blood. The knife block had been knocked over, and it appeared as if she had been in the middle of preparing a snack. There was a strainer with freshly washed blueberries in the sink and a half-cut orange still sitting on the counter. On the floor nearby were her glasses, and in her left hand, she was holding a perfectly clean white towel. At 6:31 p.m., Sam finally called 911. When the operator answered, Sam's voice was panicked and disoriented. He said, quote, "Help. I need emergency. I just walked into my apartment and my fiance's on the floor with blood everywhere," end quote. The dispatcher then asked for the address, 4601 Flat Rock Road. "Please come now," end quote. Sam told the operator he thought that Ellen might have slipped. He said that there was blood on the table and that her face looked purple, that maybe she had hit her head. For several minutes, the dispatcher urges him to check to see if she was breathing, to look at her chest, and to start CPR. However, Sam hesitated and repeated that he couldn't tell where she was bleeding from, and he asked if he had to perform CPR on her. Then, about 3 minutes into the call, Sam suddenly said something that changed everything. Quote, "Oh my God, she stabbed herself. She fell on a knife. Oh no, there's a knife sticking out of her heart," end quote. The operator told him not to touch it and to wait for help. Sam said the knife looked like it was buried in her chest, quote, "right in the heart." Ellen was 27 years old. By the end of the call, Sam told dispatch that there was no sign of a break-in, that the only damage was the apartment door, which he admitted he'd broken down himself. First responders were dispatched at 6:33 p.m. 2 minutes later, at 6:34, security footage shows a man resembling Sam's cousin arriving at the building. At 6:36 p.m., EMS and fire personnel would arrive and make their way to the sixth floor. This is where they found Sam waiting in the hallway outside of the apartment. Inside, Ellen's body was found with 20 stab wounds, 10 to the back of her neck and head, and 10 to her chest and abdomen. One knife remained lodged in her chest. But before we get to all that, there's something important to note about the timeline of Sam's call to 911. When he was unable to reach Ellen, 911 was not the first number that he dialed. Upon breaking into the apartment, phone records show that at 6:14 p.m., Sam called his cousin, Kamian Schwartzman, and that 12 minutes later, at 6:26 p.m., he answered a call from his uncle, James Schwartzman, a former prosecutor, now president judge of the Pennsylvania Court of Judicial Discipline. It was only after those two conversations that at 6:31 p.m. did Sam finally call 911. It's really hard not to question those order of events, but it is important to keep in mind that people can act unpredictably in a moment of panic and shock. Some go silent, others freeze, and apparently some people call family before they can even register what's happening. Still, in this case of Ellen Greenberg, every minute and every action would later be scrutinized. When first responders arrived, it did not take them long to assess that the scene inside the apartment was far from a simple accident. Ellen Greenberg was pronounced dead in her kitchen with 20 stab wounds total, 10 to the back of her neck, the top of her head, and another 10 in her chest and abdomen area. While police began taping off the area, paramedics and firefighters were briefing arriving officers on what they had found. The apartment security guard later said that the fire lieutenant spoke with him and he clearly heard him tell police, quote, "You've got a murder upstairs." The guard also recalled one of the responding officers turning to him and saying that he might want to head down to the station because detectives would probably need his statement for the investigation. But here's the thing, that interview never happened. Neither the security guard nor any of the building's on-duty staff were ever questioned by detectives that night. Not long after, James Schwartzman, Sam's uncle, arrived at the scene. He requested to see Sam, but police told him it wasn't necessary and that Sam didn't require counsel at the time. Sam was eventually escorted from the apartment in handcuffs and led past a crowd of first responders and down through the lobby. But what happened after that is unclear. There are no public reports detailing what was said once he left the building or what those first interviews looked like. Some sources allege that legal representation was already waiting for him when he got downstairs, but that has never been confirmed. One of the biggest inconsistencies in this case come from Sam's own statement to police that night. He told detectives that when he forced the door open, the security guard had been with him, standing beside him as he broke the latch. But years later, that guard gave a sworn declaration in 2021 directly contradicting Sam's version of events. In his statement, he said that Sam came to the front desk asking to be let into his apartment. The guard told him that he couldn't do that, that it was against policy. And Sam went back upstairs alone. He made it clear that he never accompanied Sam to the apartment, not before or after the door was broken down, and that he was the only security guard on duty that day. Even more telling, he said he had already told detectives the same exact thing during the original investigation back in 2011. He didn't change his story. And to back up his statement, he pointed to the building's security footage, which shows that no one accompanied Sam in common areas or the elevators during that time. The guard also noted one final detail. Even though it was small, it stuck with him for years. He said that Sam kept repeating that he had just come from the gym, but he found that strange because Sam wasn't wearing any gym shoes. He was only wearing outdoor boots, the kind that you would wear out in the snow and not to work out indoors. That takes us to the crime scene. When police first arrived at the Venice Lofts that cold January evening, they began documenting everything. Photos were taken of the apartment, of Ellen's body, of the kitchen where she was found. There was blood splatter on the cabinets and the floor, a fruit bowl that had been knocked over, and a half-made meal sitting on the counter. The scene of what should have been an ordinary night. By the following day, while the police were supposedly still investigating, Ellen's fiancé's uncle, Judge James Schwartzman, made a phone call to the building manager. He told her that he needed to get into the apartment to retrieve a suit for Sam so he could have something appropriate to wear for Ellen's funeral. The building manager hesitated. She hadn't been told whether police were officially done with the scene, so she did what anyone would do. She called the police department to confirm. The answer she got was shocking. They told her, quote, "The scene is cleared up. He can go in. Oh, and you can call a crime scene cleanup." End quote. That statement alone was issued less than 24 hours after Ellen's death, and it is hard to believe, but it is in the record. So Judge Schwartzman went inside the apartment, and while he was there, he didn't just grab a suit. He also collected Ellen's cell phones, her work laptop, and her personal laptop, as well as Sam's laptop, and took them from the property. Now, if the scene had officially been cleared, that might sound reasonable. But there is one major problem with that timeline. That being that no search warrant had ever been issued. Not yet. Not for that scene. The official search warrant for Ellen and Sam's apartment wasn't issued until the following day, January 28th, after Schwartzman had already entered the unit and removed multiple pieces of evidence. So let's take a second to just recap that. They authorized a search warrant after letting a family member enter the crime scene, take away key electronic devices, and told the manager that she could order a cleanup crew. The laptops were not recovered and taken back into police custody until January 29th, which was 2 days later. And by then, who knows what could have been accessed, deleted, or altered. And this right here is where the case begins to fall deep into the pit of confusion, negligence, and for many, outright corruption. Now, let's discuss Ellen's autopsy findings. Her autopsy was conducted shortly after her death by Dr. Marlon Osborne with the Philadelphia Medical Examiner's Office. And when he first reviewed the body, the conclusion seemed obvious. Ellen's death was classified as a homicide. The evidence supported it. Ellen had suffered 20 stab wounds, 10 to her back and neck, and another 10 to her chest and stomach. The knife, still protruding from her chest, was driven between her ribs and it penetrated her heart. But this wasn't all that Dr. Osborne found. Ellen's body also showed 11 bruises that were in various stages of healing, some recent, others days, weeks, and even months old, scattered across her right arm, her abdomen, her back, and her right leg. The pattern was described as consistent with someone who had been involved in contact sports or someone who had experienced repeated blunt trauma. But here's the thing. Ellen didn't play any contact sports. And at that point, the homicide ruling made sense to everyone. Yet, Just one day later, the Philadelphia Police Department made a public statement walking back the medical examiner's finding. They said, quote, "The death of Ellen Greenberg has not been ruled a homicide. Homicide investigators are considering the manner of death as suspicious at this time." And then within just 3 weeks, everything changed. On February 18th, 2011, Dr. Osborne formally reversed his ruling, and Ellen's manner of death was changed from homicide to suicide. When questioned under oath about that change, Dr. Osborne admitted that the reversal came after a meeting with multiple people, members of the district attorney's office, members of the Philadelphia Police Department, and his superior, the chief medical examiner. He said that that meeting was called because investigating officers had requested that the manner of death be changed from homicide to pending. When asked under oath if such a meeting had ever been held to reclassify a death before, Dr. Osborne simply replied, "No, never." He claimed his decision was based on reviewing Ellen's psychiatric records, crime scene reports, and the crime scene photos, and information that suggested that she may have been struggling with anxiety. Because when you look at the details, the logic doesn't hold up. One of the main pieces of so-called, quote, evidence used to support the suicide theory is that Ellen had searched for information about suicide on her laptop. However, the Greenberg family attorney hired independent forensic experts to examine her devices, and their findings were completely different. Their analysis found no evidence of genuine suicide-related searches. Instead, what they discovered were what they call phantom searches. Search results that appeared in metadata due to auto-generated analytics or unrelated keyword associations, not because someone had actually typed them. Ellen's father, Josh, explained that his daughter had been researching the side effect of her anxiety medication, and those searches sometimes brought up mentions of suicide as a known risk. But that's it. In fact, according to the official police report, when Ellen's laptop was found, the screen was still open, not to anything dark or concerning, but to wedding planning websites. Ellen was literally planning her future. There was no suicide note, no message to loved ones, and no indication of intent. Yet, despite 20 stab wounds, 10 of them in areas of her body that she could have physically not reached, her death remains officially ruled as a suicide. Now, let's talk about the forensics, because this is where this entire case starts to unravel. If you remember, Ellen was found in her kitchen, sitting slumped against the cabinets with a knife still lodged in her chest. The blade was buried roughly 4 inches deep, and she had 20 stab wounds total. Right away, something about that didn't sit right with many investigators, and especially not with independent forensic experts who later reviewed the evidence. First, the sheer number of wounds. Most suicides involving sharp force injuries result in 1 or 2 fatal strikes. 20 is almost unheard of. And the location of where those wounds are really raise even more questions. Some of them were in the back of her neck, which is an area that's physically difficult, if not impossible, to reach. And to reach it with enough force to penetrate as deeply as hers did. Others were on top of her head, which would require extreme contorted angles to self-inflict. Then there was the absence of defensive wounds. There were no cuts on Ellen's hands, no bruising on her palm or fingers, nothing suggesting that she had fought off an attacker. But there were also no hesitation marks, the shallow test wounds that are typically seen in suicide by stabbing. So what does that leave us with? A scene that doesn't make sense either way. One forensic pathologist described the case as an anatomical impossibility for self-infliction. Another said bluntly, quote, "You cannot stab yourself 20 times, 10 of them in the back of your own neck." It's worth noting that Ellen was found sitting upright, leaning against the kitchen cabinets. Blood was pooled beneath her, and there was remarkably little splatter on the surrounding walls. Experts have said that suggests that she may have been moved after death or she was already in the seating position when the stabbing occurred. Again, inconsistent with a self-inflicted act. Now, one of the most confusing and highly debated pieces of this case revolves around the swing latch on the apartment door. According to her fiance, Sam, he came back from the gym and he claims that he found the door locked from the inside by the swing latch, the kind that can only be engaged manually from within the apartment. He said that was the proof that no one else could have entered or left. However, when police and forensic specialists examined the latch, things got complicated. The damage to the latch didn't fully match the story of a forced break-in. Some experts have suggested that it could have been manipulated or relatched after the fact, either intentionally or by accident. Later reenactments by investigators, journalists, and even YouTubers demonstrate that it was entirely possible to pull the swing latch closed from the outside by using a simple tool or a string. So, was the door truly locked from the inside, or was it made to look that way? Adding to the confusion, no one else's fingerprints or DNA were reportedly found in the apartment other than Ellen and Sam's. But here's the problem: the scene was already compromised. Remember that the apartment had been accessed multiple times before the search warrant was even issued, and there's simply no way to know what evidence may have been wiped, lost, or tampered with. Independent experts also reviewed the blood patterns and the knife trajectories, and those results have only deepened the mystery. Several of Ellen's back wounds were angled downward, meaning the weapon entered from above and behind her, which doesn't align with the self-inflicted motion. One stab to the back of her neck penetrated deep enough to hit her spinal cord, which would have likely incapacitated her almost immediately. So, in other words, if that wound occurred early in the attack, Ellen wouldn't have had the strength or the mobility to continue stabbing herself another 19 times. Then there's the knife itself. It was part of a standard kitchen block with an 8-inch blade. There were no blood drips or fingerprints leading from the handle to the sink, nor evidence she had tried to wash her hands or the knife between wounds. Her left hand was still clutching that perfectly clean white towel, which some experts suggest may have been staged, or at the very least indicate she wasn't holding the knife when she fell. Yet, despite all of this, her death remains ruled a suicide. Reports also indicate that one of the stab wounds punctured her lungs, which again would have made it almost impossible for her to continue with the strength to finish stabbing herself. And yet, despite all this, her death remains ruled a suicide. Over the years, Ellen's parents, Josh and Sandy Greenberg, have fought tirelessly to have her case reopened and reclassified. They've hired multiple independent experts, forensic pathologists, and crime scene analysis, as well as digital investigators, all of whom have come to the same conclusion, which is that Ellen did not take her own life. They've taken their fight through the courts, appealing to the Attorney General's office, the governor's office, and the media. Each time, they've been met with bureaucratic pushback or silence. The Greenbergs' legal team has repeatedly pointed to clear procedural errors, the premature release of the scene, the lack of the initial search warrant, and the mishandling of evidence and the inconsistencies in Sam's statements. And yet, year after year, official agencies continue to stand by the ruling of suicide. More than 14 years later, after Ellen Greenberg was found stabbed to death in her Philadelphia apartment, her case continues to divide experts and spark outrage, as well as haunt those who have followed it from the beginning. In February of 2025, the city of Philadelphia quietly agreed to reopen a comprehensive review of Ellen's death following a lengthy legal battle led by her parents. For over a decade, they fought to overturn what they always believed was an impossible conclusion, that their daughter, a vibrant 27-year-old schoolteacher, had somehow stabbed herself 20 times, including 10 times in the head and neck. This review wasn't just a bureaucratic formality. it was prompted by explosive new evidence and a shocking revelation from the very man who had originally classified Ellen's death as a suicide, Dr. Marlon Osborne, the city's medical examiner at the time. In a sworn statement, Dr. Osborne admitted that he had been pressured by both Philadelphia Police Department and the district's attorney's office to change Ellen's cause of death from homicide to suicide. He called the decision, quote, a mistake, and confessed that he had serious doubts about the evidence even at the time. His admission reignited public anger and gave Ellen's parents fresh hope that the truth would finally come out. Just when it seemed like progress was being made, in October 2025, Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Lindsay Simon released a 32-page report reaffirming that Ellen Greenberg's death would remain classified as a suicide. Dr. Simon's report was meticulous, dense, and depending on who you ask, either deeply flawed or carefully reasoned. She acknowledged that the distribution of Ellen's wounds was unusual, insisted that they were consistent with a self-inflicted act of violence during what she described as a psychological break. Simon pointed to Ellen's recent struggles with anxiety and work-related stress, noting she had recently been prescribed new medication and was apparently feeling overwhelmed by her job. Her report theorized that she may have suffered a dissociative episode and an intense brief surge of panic or mental detachment that could have triggered a violent outburst directed inward. But to many people, including the Greenberg family, independent forensic experts, and even former prosecutors, that explanation sounded like a narrative of gymnastics because the physical evidence just doesn't add up. So, what does the evidence still say? Ellen's body bore 20 stab wounds in total, though later through forensic analysis, they identified 23 separate injuries, including some small punctures that were never noted in the original autopsy. Among them were multiple deep wounds in the back of her neck and skull, several penetrating the chest cavity and abdomen, and even more troubling, the knife was embedded in her chest and buried up to the handle. There were no defensive wounds on her hands or forearms, but bruises covered her body, over 20 in total, in various stages of healing. The Greenbergs' attorneys have argued that the bruises tell a far different story, one of chronic physical abuse that was never properly investigated. Forensic pathologists hired by the family recreated Ellen's wounds using 3D modeling and concluded that several of the self-inflicted stabs to the back of her neck would have been impossible to self-inflict, especially given the angle and depth of penetration. Others noted that the knife's handle was clean, suggesting that it had been wiped down. Despite these red flags, Simon's report doubled down on the suicide theory, citing a locked apartment door with no sign of forced entry, no third-party DNA found on the weapon, and time-stamped building surveillance that alleged Samuel Goldberg's accounts of where he was that evening. In Simon's own words, Ellen's wounds were admittedly extreme, but still, she said, they could be explained by a sudden, unrestrained act of self-harm. That statement was the final straw for many who had been following this case. The response was swift, and Ellen's parents call the new ruling, quote, devastating and dishonest. Their attorney, Joseph Padraza, described the city's report as, quote, an insult to the intelligence of anyone who has read the autopsy, end quote. He accused the officials of selective interpretation of evidence, arguing that the review ignored clear contradictions from the tampered door lock to the missing surveillance footage to the inconsistencies in the Goldbergs' statements. Padraza went further, accusing the city of a cover-up and saying the 2025 report was an attempt to, quote, protect the reputations of those who mishandled this case from the start, end quote. The Greenbergs have since vowed to continue their legal fight and petitioning for a federal oversight and independent medical review outside of Pennsylvania's jurisdiction. A new hearing is scheduled for later this month where the judge will decide whether the suicide ruling can finally be overturned or whether Ellen's case will remain sealed behind the same closed doors it's been trapped behind for over a decade. Ellen's story has also exploded back into the public consciousness thanks to a recent Hulu documentary, Death in Apartment 603, What Happened to Ellen Greenberg? The series dives deep into the contradictions of the case, featuring forensic experts, legal analysis, and close friends who echo the same disbelief that Ellen could not have done this to herself. The documentary reveals never-before-seen photos, original police interviews, and even testimony from witnesses who claim they were discouraged from speaking to detectives. Notably, Samuel Goldberg, Ellen's fiancé, and the last person to see her alive, declined to participate. Public opinion has only grown more skeptical. Online forums and true crime communities and investigative journalists have all questioned how 20 stab wounds could ever be dismissed as self-inflicted and whether someone powerful is being protected behind the scenes. At this point, the case seems to sit at a crossroads between science and speculation, and there are a few key theories that continue to dominate the conversation. One is murder and evidence tampering. This is the Greenberg family's position. They believe that Ellen was murdered and that the crime scene was staged to look like a suicide. The locked door, they argue, could have been manipulated from the outside using a swing lock mechanism, and even the timing of the events, particularly the delay in calling 911, raises even more questions. Theory number two is of an institutional cover-up. Many believe the police and DA's office pushed for the suicide ruling to avoid the embarrassment of mishandling what should have been a homicide investigation. Dr. Osborne's admission of outside pressure only fuels this theory further. Three is domestic abuse and lethal confrontation. Some believe Ellen's death may have been the tragic result of an escalating domestic dispute. The bruises, the inconsistencies in Samuel's statements, and the timeline of events all point towards a confrontation that may have turned deadly, one later staged to conceal the truth. Despite the latest ruling, Ellen's parents continue their fight. They've said that they will never stop until their daughter's death is rightfully classified as a homicide and her killer is brought to justice. It's now been over 14 years, and what began as a straightforward death investigation has become a battle between citizens and the system. A question of not only who killed Ellen Greenberg, but how far institutions will go to protect themselves from admitting a mistake. And if history has shown us anything, it's that truth has a way of resurfacing even years after being buried. Sometimes the truth doesn't die with the victim. It lingers, like a whisper trapped inside four apartment walls and echoing long after the sirens fade. Ellen Greenberg was 27 years old. She was engaged, and she had a future that was all mapped out. A wedding, a classroom full of students who adored her, and parents who would have given anything to protect her. And yet somehow, her story ended with 20 stab wounds, a locked door, and a city that decided she did it to herself. For more than a decade, her parents have fought against a machine that seems determined to close the file and call it solved. But when you look closer, when you really look, you start to realize that this case isn't about just one woman's death. It's about what happens when a system designed to protect the truth decide to bury it instead. Ellen's story isn't over. Not even close. Because stories like hers don't rest quietly. They pulse beneath the surface, in documents, in evidence photos, and in the hearts of the people who refuse to give up. And maybe that's what makes this case so haunting. It's not just the violence, it's the silence that followed, the unanswered questions, the inconsistencies, and the eerie feeling that someone somewhere knows exactly what happened and still sleeps soundly at night. As we close tonight's episode, I can't help but think about Ellen's last moments and how quickly her light was taken from this world. But I also think about her parents, who have carried that light every day since, refusing to let it dim. And maybe one day, that light will finally expose the truth. And maybe then, Ellen Greenberg will finally rest. Until then, the questions remain. Thank you so much for tuning into another episode of Dark Florida. As always, if you want to connect with me and follow along with everything happening behind the scenes, be sure to give us a follow on Instagram at Dark Florida Podcast, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/@darkflorida411. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/darkflorida. And if you have a story to share, would like to be a guest on the show, or have a suggestion of a topic I should cover, please email me at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. And if you're enjoying the show, be sure to share it with a friend and leave a 5-star review. It really helps. Until next time, stay curious and stay strange.